When it comes to murder, entertainers are usually at the receiving end of the violence. But celebrities are just like us, and some of them have committed stone-cold homicide.
As a follow-up to our previous two podcasts with drag queen Peaches Christ on actors who were killed and actresses who were murdered, Peaches joins us once again to take a look at actors accused of murder. Some did it, some didn't, and some may have gotten away with it.
Listen as Peaches Christ kills us with her humor and wisdom as we take a look at some of the most memorable celebrity killers of all time.
Plus, how John Wilkes Booth really stole the show and changed American history.
The rise of tabloid media in Fatty Arbuckle's trial for murder.
And the racial divide in public opinion over O.J. Simpson's guilt or innocence.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people just like you. Thank you. Become a member and support this show at feastoffun.com/plus.
Hello.
Hi, is this Peaches Christ?
Yes, it is.
Please hold.
Excuse me?
Somewhere over the rainbow. Hello, Peaches. It's Fausto.
And Mark from Feast of Fun. How are you?
Hi, good. How are you guys?
I'm doing pretty good. Can't complain.
I love that you still say from the Feast of Fun.
Well, you have to remind listeners who what's happening, right?
Okay, but you're not reminding me.
No.
I don't know where your life has been. I don't know what kind of crises and challenges you're facing.
That's true. I could have had a mental break.
And for somebody who has an awful lot of photos of her licking a bloody knife, I don't know what kind of crazy shit you have to deal with on a daily basis.
That makes sense. I accept that.
Part of your time every year is surrounded by simulation of dead bodies and people being decapitated and being stabbed.
Yes, it's true. It's true. I am surrounded by that stuff. And now even more so now that this haunted attraction business I have has gotten into full swing. We have a year-round office now, and we of course put some standees and mannequins. Next to my desk is a really crazy, scary clown named Puddles. And next to my colleague David's desk is this really rotten, decaying zombie.
Heclina?
No, believe it or not. Not that scary.
It's just scary enough.
So people walk in and kind of freak out because they're like life-size mannequins. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people freak out when they come into this house because we have a mannequin, Alita, here. And people are always like, oh, my God, I thought that was a real person.
I think, really? Is that Valentina? And I'm like, yeah, it's a sculpture of Valentina because we can't get the real one on the show.
Yeah, we're just such big fans.
Well, she's got big tits.
Yes, she does.
Not Valentina.
Valentina is a very good Christian woman. This one, this Alita smorgasbord, she is a woman to pleasure those who enjoy large bosoms.
I remember when you guys got her, how you had to, like, you know, hose her down for 2 hours outside just to get rid of all the semen.
Actually, you know what? We don't know what the story is like because I've never taken a black.
Oh, yes, we do.
I've never taken a black.
That thing is covered in that old man's DNA.
Do you think I should get a black light and see?
I think you should. I can't believe you haven't already.
You know, I do have a black light and I've been meaning to do it. So one of these days we'll see.
We'll film it.
Yeah. We don't know if it was.
One for Patreon.
The question is like, was he sexually attracted to this mannequin, or was was the mannequin an avatar for his gender identity?
Maybe both.
Yeah, maybe both.
So, for people who are like, what are they talking about? Mike Dale Martin. He was a retired Korean War veteran, lived in Beloit, Wisconsin, and for the last 30 years of his life, every year he built a certain number of large bosomed mannequins. To the point that his wife was fed up with it and moved out. And it was just him and these mannequins, like a Twilight Zone episode. Mm-hmm. And then he died and they had this auction. And we talked about it on the show. And the listeners were like, Feast of Fun needs to have this mannequin. I'm like, no, guys, we really have internet bills and things to host. Please don't do that. And they bid on it. And they're like, here you go, Fausto. Mark, we love you. And I'm like, oh, God. So on a Saturday morning at 7 a.m. in the morning, I got in the car by myself with a cold, and I drove to Beloit, Wisconsin, through cornfields and cornfields and cornfields. Was this little mansion, little house filled with these giant titted mannequins. And now she's in our home and she's part of our life.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how many there were? I mean, 70, it's pretty fascinating.
It seemed like a lot more, and that's what the press reported on.
Like, more than two dozen?
At the time of his death, the press reported that he had 70 mannequins.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
Because he was,
and at one point, were they ever going to just sell them off as an entire lot?
I don't know. I know that like a museum of outsider art in L.A. bought like five or six of them.
So fascinating. That is my favorite kind of art, honestly. Mm. And I love that kind of museum. Mm. Because it's sort of like... Yeah, like this guy, I mean, you know, he was driven to create, clearly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having seen Alita up close, I have to say the quality of the craftsmanship is quite good.
Well, the breasts are made from Bondo, that stuff that you use to repair cars. So you can make it and then you just kind of sand it smooth and there you go. So he would sand those titties smooth.
They're very smooth. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's tricky, though, living with a work of outsider art in your home, because inevitably people ask you, like, did you make this? Do you have sex with it? Do you, you know what I'm saying? Like, I imagine that people who live with like a Picasso hanging in their living room have the same kind of, complicated relationship if people don't recognize it for the work of art that it is. They just think, this person had a seizure and doesn't know how to draw.
Right.
Mm. And part of it is like, you know, in preparing for the show and just, you know, researching and looking at actors who either have murdered somebody or were accused of murdering somebody, it struck upon me how dangerous and... dangerous the realm of being a celebrity. And you are somebody who you work with a lot of people, different kinds of people, a lot of different peoples of abilities and states of mind and thresholds. Have you ever been in a situation where you feared for your life or you wanted to kill somebody?
I'm actually taking the question seriously, so I'm really thinking. I definitely didn't ever seriously want to kill somebody.
Not even more tiny.
No,
well, you've murdered many people.
If I'm answering seriously, no.
but you've murdered a lot of people. Pretend on stage, right?
I could answer as Peaches, but I'm thinking seriously. Like I'm trying to think if I ever feared for my life. Yes, I have, honestly, but it wasn't from other people I would call colleagues. One was a person I cast in a show who, you know, she was very, very nice. Very strange, very eccentric, which totally is all good in our world. But my gut said there was something off about her, and I didn't follow my gut, and I kind of felt bad because she was definitely like an oddball. And so I cast her in a show, and sure enough, she was problematic, like immediately. And so I let her know that I didn't think it was going to work out. And then that set off a shitstorm of attention, you know. Mm. So I actually did think maybe she would wait for me, you know, because she went kind of ballistic. Not just when I let her go, but like, you know, Twitter and social media and, you know, just all sorts of stuff.
And did it eventually like de-escalate, I assume? Or?
I can't actually talk about it totally because it went to a place of the cops and lawyers and things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can we talk about Sharon Needles' home being burned down by one of her fans?
Well, I would assume you can.
Well, we don't know who did it.
We still don't know to this day.
Right. And that's not germane to what we're talking about today.
I just love that story. That is the terrifying story, you know?
So what is the story? I mean, I don't even know if I know that story. I know that...
She was supposed to perform here in Chicago at a local bar and stuff. And we went to see her and they're like, Sharon's not going to be here tonight because somebody set her house on fire. And then she did a video message and we were very honored. She was wearing a Feast of Fun t-shirt during her video message. And then later on, we found out that her apartment that she had been living in was set on fire. And, you know, there are some people that say, like, oh, it could have been this person, it could have been that person. But they're like the main person who she'd had a falling out with had some kind of alibi. But, you know, Sharon's, she knows how to piss off people, right? I mean, she's had, like, bricks thrown at her, like, when she's...
Well, just, I have to say, I'm really, really impressed by the intensity with which Pittsburgh queens battle one another. I would not say that it's unique to Sharon, because when I went to Pittsburgh, I was like, I met all these queens who I adore, you know, Sharon and Baby Moon and Bambi and Cherry Bomb and all these great queens. Mm-hmm. And but like they'd be like, oh, you see that toothless bitch? I punched her tooth out, you know, and I'm like, what? I'm not even lying. Like, oh my God. It was just totally normal, like, for people to, like, kind of attack each other and have fist fights and, you know. I think it's just, you know, part of the culture there.
Mm.
Well, is this a culture of, like, drag queens? You know, like, I remember interviewing Holly Woodlawn, and she would say that some of these queens in New York City were so violent, they would have razor blades in their hair.
Well, you put the razor blades in your hair in case somebody went for your wig or for your hair, and then they would get cut. And she's like, you know, you've seen this in movies. I think it was in the movie Coffee or something like that.
Yes,
she's
it
like,
was. Good job, Mark. Thank that you is very much. Exactly where it comes from.
Always it's happy. Always happy to please Peaches. But yeah, and she said that she literally like they would actually do that because these queens would fight with each other on the street. But you know, when you're on the street, when you're working the street, you've got corners. You have you've got your turf because you're probably selling sex. Maybe you're selling some dime bags here and there too. And so you know, you have to be armed and dangerous.
But even if people get like on RuPaul's Drag Race, even if they become viral internet superstars, they still have merch they want to sell, and those queens sometimes come for each other. And part of it, like here in Chicago, they sometimes come after us, you know? And I'm just like, I don't even know. Like, they come after us for not fighting with them. That's the crazy thing. Like, Mark and I are trying to be as neutral as possible. We try to remove ourselves from the situation as much as we can. And they're like, I can't believe you're not taking sides. Well, you know, and part of it is this regressive idea that, like, if you're not with us, you're against us.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the nature of being an entertainer and being in show business, even though it strikes a lot of people as very glamorous, can actually be very dangerous.
Well, and you know, in this podcast, I invited you to come and talk about this because we've already talked about actors who were murdered. And then we were like, let's do actresses who were murdered. And so we did another podcast on that. And then I was just like, wait a second. What about actors who've actually killed people? And so I was just like, what do you think of this? And you're like, you were game for it. And during our research, we discovered that like most of the actors that have actually killed someone, they did it while driving a car. So a lot of it was unintentional homicide. But what I've learned is that celebrities are just really terrible drivers.
So instead of like, you know, comedians and cars getting coffee, a new series could be like celebrities and cars killing people. And you saw T.S. Madison with Bianca Del Rio. I don't know if you guys watched that video. So T.S. Madison is doing like, you know, her knockoff of RuPaul's knockoff of Jerry Seinfeld's show. And she's in the car driving around and they almost get into a car accident on camera with T.S. Madison behind the wheel.
You know, wear your seatbelt.
And you know,
oh really?
Yeah,
I thought RuPaul drove it. Oh, so T.S. Madison has the same show.
Yeah, so RuPaul's not interested in doing it anymore. So T.S. Madison took over, and so
Ru doesn't do her version at all anymore.
I don't think so.
Okay,
that I'm aware of. But you've ridden in a car with RuPaul at the wheel, right?
No, I was at the wheel.
Would you say you're a good driver, Peaches? Was RuPaul scared?
I think I'm a good driver. When I got my driver's license when I was 16, my nickname was Crash because I had like, I don't know, like four accidents or something like crazy. And my parents were like so over me. But then, since then, I've not had an accident, you know?
Because you've ridden in a car with us behind the wheel. Who do you think is the safer driver?
I only really ever remember Mark driving.
That's right, because I'm the safer driver.
I don't remember you ever driving.
Because I won't let him.
Oh, please. Yeah.
You guys have a very heteronormative relationship. Like, Mark is the man, Fausto's the woman. Do you know what I mean? Think about it.
Yeah, very true.
Oh, yeah. Very true. My God.
Well, let's talk about Shady Queens from Maryland. The most famous murderer.
Who?
Is John Wilkes Booth.
Mm. Oh, is he from Maryland?
He's from your hometown, girl. Mm. And so,
wow, I didn't know that.
He was a member of the prominent Booth theatrical family. He was a celebrity in his day, very celebrated actor, and a horrible racist who felt that the country was going to the hell in a handbasket because they were getting rid of slavery. And a lot of racist people in the North were very, very angry at Abraham Lincoln. And so he conspired with other people. They were actually thinking of kidnapping Lincoln, but then he just went, ah, fuck it, and just shot him in the back.
Wow. He was, yeah. He really stole the show.
It's so weird because you, yeah, I was surprised to learn that John Wilkes Booth had been famous before the assassination. You know, that I'd kind of not realized, but then when I got your notes for the show, I was, you know, looking it up, and yeah, he was a successful actor.
Mm-hmm. He came from a family of actors. That would be like, yeah, you know, like
Will Smith's son,
Kirk Douglas or something, yeah, like that. killing people. Or Michael Douglas.
Michael Douglas killing Obama. Mm-hmm. That would be the thing.
Or like Drew Barrymore.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he escaped on horseback, and he was hiding, like, he was hiding in different places, and they finally found him hiding in a barn, and he wouldn't come out, so they set the barn on fire, and as he came out, they shot him to death. Mm-hmm.
Isn't that amazing that back then, with so little technology, they were able to find him? You kind of have to wonder, like, how much of an idiot do you have to be to not be able to hide?
I mean, he's an actor too. He could put on a wig and be like, oh, John Wilkes Booth.
Oh, like, how did they track him down?
Right? He could have dressed up in drag and just hidden in plain sight.
Well, the thing is, though, too, is you got to remember you're on horseback too, and horses were relatively hard to come by, and your horse gets tired. And when your horse gets tired, it's not going to run anymore. So what are you going to do? You're going to get, stop somewhere. And I think he,
I guess they could follow the hoof prints.
Yeah.
He was only 26 years old when he died.
Oh, man.
Oh, wow.
Well, he was shot. I'm sorry. He didn't die of natural causes. But he died in the same way that Abraham Lincoln did.
He was shot.
He was shot to death, yeah.
I forget which one it was. One of the newscasters that was popular during the 80s or something like that was his father treated his wounds or something like that.
By Austin Corbett.
Oh, is that who it was?
That's who it says killed him.
Ah. But no, somebody treated his wounds like...
It was a Union soldier named Boston Corbett.
That's Boston Corbett's the guy who caught him and shot him.
We have this idea of entertainers and actors as being very celebrated or sophisticated, but in the history of the United States, there's always been a lot of backlash in arts and entertainment, and a lot of religious fundamentalists have always historically seen it as threatening their racket of, you know, running a church. If you're going to the movies, you're not spending money and going to the church, right? And, you know, you got to keep them in the pews. And so throughout America's history, there's always been this like push and pull in progressives and regressive people trying to remove or destroy theater and filmmaking. And so the story of Fatty Arbuckle, or Roscoe Arbuckle, lands square and center in America's very complicated relationship with Hollywood, where they love it and they hate it.
Because I grew up thinking, like, you know, in the mythology, as you heard, that Fatty Arbuckle smothered a woman to death during sex, and he was charged.
Who was Fatty Arbuckle?
Fatty Arbuckle was a comedian at the time during the silent era, mostly, and he did a lot of, you know, films, and he got paid a lot of money. He was making like $1 million for a film, which is a lot of money back in 1921.
At the time, he was the world's highest paid actor. From what I'm
he was also notably one of the first people to do drag in movies.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, because drag was a big part of vaudeville, and a lot of Charlie Chaplin and Fatty Arbuckle. These were all people that sort of went from very modest origins into superstardom. And so he left Keystone Studios to help start Paramount Studios. And Cukor, who also, he's the guy responsible for hiring Judy Garland. He basically made all these movies for him, but he was also like a prankster. And I guess Cukor's Iger like was very bruised, and so he had an uneasy relationship with him. But so Roscoe Arbuckle made three films back to back and went to San Francisco to relax. And I guess his demeanor was very one that he was very a modest person, very shy. But he surrounded himself with party goers because he loved to pull pranks. And he had this party in his hotel room where a young ingenue by the name of Virginia Rappet visited. And it was, probably a party about 12 people or so. It was in and she passed out. She had too much to drink. And then about a couple days later, she died. And at that party was also this other woman named Maud Delmont, who was a huckster, who, according to the BBC, a documentary about her, they said she was guilty of every crime except murder. And she extorted Roscoe Arbuckle for money. And later on, she was the one responsible for feeding this media hysteria. And at the same time, District Attorney Matthew Brady was wanting to launch his political career. He had aspirations to become president. And so he partnered with William Randolph Hearst to basically slander Roscoe Arbuckle, saying that he had crushed poor young Virginia to death. And that's why she died, because of a broken bladder.
During sex.
Now, years and years later, forensic scientists actually found out that Virginia had probably covered up a series of abortions, and that her medical condition and her state of physical being was because of the fact that she had some bad abortions and had compromised the integrity of her bladder and her internal organs.
Yikes.
So despite all this, all this is happening while prohibition had been passed, and a lot of conservative, regressive politicians were trying to attack Hollywood and saying that Hollywood was full of these enormous drunken men like Fatty Arbuckle, who crush these poor innocent women, and we need to regulate, if not ban, these movies from our communities around the world. Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin, who were close friends and they were proteges of Arbuckle, were kept from talking about it due to concerns that a puritanical backlash on Hollywood would destroy the film industry completely.
And the Hays Code evolved out of this kind of thing, too, right? And the Hays, actually, there was a guy, and he banned Fatty Arbuckle from even performing in film.
Yeah.
And then eventually he relented and said, okay, you can go back to film. But all the damage to this guy's reputation had been done. He had gone to court three times. Two times it was left in mistrial, and then one time they were just kind of like, they just threw it out. They're like, no, he's not guilty.
It killed Fatty Arbuckle. The Hays Code was put in effect in 1930. And then seriously enforced in 1934, and Roscoe Arbuckle died in 1933, and he died penniless, and he died in abject poverty, even though at one point in time he was the world's richest actor. And since then, and really what Hollywood is, and how Hollywood is very anxious about having this puritanical morality, in the films, that all stem from the Arbuckle scandal. The way we think about movies, the way we think about like how movies have to have these wholesome, values, or the villain has to meet their end. Mm-hmm. Films before Prohibition were very progressive. They showed homosexuality in film. They showed cross-dressing. Mm-hmm. Charlie Chaplin and Roscoe Arbuckle and all the comedians of the day, they were cross-dressers. Laurel and Hardy. I mean, you think about like Bugs Bunny and all those cartoons. All that stuff happened before the Hays Code was fully put into effect. So, your heritage is from a time period long ago. The origins of drag in American popular culture really stem from that period of permissiveness before the Hays Code was passed. We owe so much as drag queens to that time period.
Yes. And that Fatty Arbuckle incident is fascinating for a number of reasons. One of which is that they actually were coming, that happened in San Francisco. It did not happen in Los Angeles.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they were coming, the celebrities were coming to San Francisco on the weekends to be as debaucherous and wild and crazy as they wanted to be, because the paparazzi didn't come up here at the time. They didn't follow them. They didn't even know they were here.
It was outside of the TMZ.
Yes. So, yeah. Well, yeah. So that changed everything.
Now, Peaches, at that time period, how long would have it taken to get from Los Angeles to San Francisco by car, I guess? Or how did they get there? Train?
Probably train, I would guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So it was a day. It was a good
You could drive. Day. You could probably fly, or you could, well, flying probably not so much, right?
So they would take a train to San Francisco, mm-hmm. and that's how they would get around.
I would guess. Yeah, that would be my guess. Mm-hmm. In the 20s? Yeah.
And so it was very difficult for the press in Los Angeles, or the national press station there, to sort of hunt down these entertainers.
Yeah, probably they could take, like, you know, have a fabulous, you know, car on the train and drink all the way up to San Francisco. And then, you know, they, you know, that happened at the, you know, Sir Francis Drake and, or is that where it happened? Where did the Fatty Arbuckle thing happen?
Yeah. I'm not sure the hotel where it took place, but part of it is that that incident took place at a time period where Americans were starving for news about these entertainers. You know, we sort of think of celebrities and entertainment news as ubiquitous, but at that time period, there was not even a lot of publications covering the stuff. And people were enamored with motion pictures, and they just felt that the actors that played them were even larger than the films themselves. So William Randolph Hearst, which is the grandfather of Patty Hearst, right?
Or great-grandfather? Something like that.
You know, he just started making up shit, you know, because they were just, and it was cute. It was fun. It was fun to be crazy and speculative. And he said that the story about Arbuckle sold more papers than the sinking of that ship, the Lithuania?
Lusitania?
Lusitania, that ignited World War I. So, like, Americans were just as obsessed with the Arbuckle scandal as they were with the events that started World War I.
Well, I mean, he was like one of the biggest stars going at the time. So I don't know, like, to compare it to today, it'd be like, I don't know, like Brad Pitt. Mm-hmm. Well, then again, we have had horrible things come out about people we, you know, put up on a pedestal. I mean, that Michael Jackson documentary is so devastating. The Bill Cosby scandal is so awful.
Mm. But even talking about Arbuckle today in 2019, you still have people on, like, the videos for, and even talking about this on the show, I'm surprised if some of our listeners don't go, you know, Fatty Arbuckle did murder that woman. You know, like, people still to this day and age have very strong feelings for or against Arbuckle. Mm-hmm.
I think growing up, it's just you hear the myth that he had sex with this woman and he crushed her to death. And it's like, I grew up believing that. And it wasn't until we started researching this stuff, I was like, oh my God, Fatty was innocent this whole time.
Well, the BBC did this wonderful mm-hmm. documentary about the early days of Hollywood. And you can watch mm-hmm. that on, we'll post that on the show notes mm-hmm. today. You can really sort of follow how much the Arbuckle story shaped entertainment and news, and we're still dealing with the repercussions today, you know, mm-hmm. like all this stuff about misinformation, about, you know, the press sort of being irresponsible with stories, about politicians having a vendetta and using high profile cases to, you know, launch their careers as politicians. That's we're still dealing with this stuff today, 100 mm-hmm. years later.
Yeah, it's super complex.
Yeah, no, I just, you know, think that whole, all of these examples are really, really extreme. But in general, culturally, as far as celebrity goes, as much as an audience loves to build someone up and celebrate them, they also like to tear them down and see them fall.
Mm. Sure.
It's the Greek tragedy, you know?
Yeah.
Well, we're just obsessed with these larger-than-life figures who outshine the very films and projects and TV shows that we enjoy. And so we just are starving for news and information about it, you know?
You know what's weird, though, with doing this show? I just have to say it. I actually thought there would be more celebrities who had killed people in interesting
You're
ways.
You're disappointed.
There aren't that many, mm-hmm. really. You know what I mean? I mean, there's, of course, OJ. Mm-hmm. I mean, that in our lifetime is probably the ultimate, right? I mean,
do you think he did it?
I do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that there's this new theory you know, that he was covering up his son's actions.
His son who had some mental health issues, and he was expecting, yeah. And the son was a chef, and he was expecting Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman to come eat at the restaurant. He had prepared this food for them, and they never showed up, and he came and was angry and then murdered them.
And Jason Simpson had been off his medications, and he was considered violent. And O.J. Simpson helped to cover up the crime.
Either way, it's horrible. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. For me, O.J. was a known abuser of women. And so I think men who beat women, men who are violent against women consistently, I don't think that there's really a large leap with that kind of anger problem to, you know, a murder of passion. Like, it's just not hard for me to believe at all. And so I don't, you know, I don't think it was random. And I think there was a lot of evidence. But I think in our lifetime, that will always be, you know, unless something else happens. But I mean, that was just, I mean, and, you know, that's the celebrity, right? I mean, he was in movies. He was a professional athlete. He was on television commercials, you know, game shows. I mean, everything.
He was considered a comedian.
Yeah, I mean, he was just everywhere.
People loved and adored him. I mean, and then he wrote a book, If I Did It, which detailed the crime as if he had done it. And, you know, people protested against it so much that they actually pulled it from publication. I'm sure you probably can find a copy of it somewhere, maybe on the interweb somewhere.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting to see what his take on that is.
It makes more sense to me that Jason Simpson did it and the father helped to cover it up. That's just my instinct there and reading about it, you know, but I always like interesting. It's like when you talk to people who are very obsessed with the story, like this ain't the Jussie Smollett. Like, I have a lot of African-American friends. The second that Jussie Smollett story came forward, they were all like, Jussie Smollett did it. He is staging a crime, you know.
Whereas it's the exact opposite with the O.J. Simpson. Is like those people who decided he was guilty and people who decided he was innocent really did go along racial lines. I worked at Michael Jordan's restaurant at the time that he was going through the trial. And it's like all the black people that I worked with were all like, oh, no, he's totally innocent. The cops have totally set him up. And to me, it seemed evident to me like that he had killed her, especially when, like you said, you hear about the abuse. And, you know, we know that that kind of stuff can escalate into murder, and most of the times women are murdered, they're murdered by their husbands or their ex-husbands, you know.
Well, I remember being a student at Penn State at the time, growing up privileged and white, and you know, really kind of living in a bubble, and you know, just starting to have an awakening in college through courses about, you know, things like misogyny and homophobia and racism, you know, but really only sort of scratching the surface. You know, it was mind-blowing, the reaction on campus, because white students clearly felt one way and black students felt another. And that's when I really kind of had a sort of an awakening as far as like, you know, I was friends with black folks. I was friends with, you know, I thought I understood, you know, but it was, I mean, there was a divide and that OJ, the cultural the reaction to it was so different based, you know, on identity and race. And it wasn't until, I mean, sad to say, and I wanted to understand, but I didn't, you know, I really didn't. But then, you know, as, technology evolved, because the thing is, you don't, when you grow up privileged, you don't want to believe that the world sucks. It's inconvenient, you know, to believe that. We don't, we know there's racism, but we don't want to believe it's horrible and rampant and systematic. You know, like that messes with my privilege. And it wasn't until later, you know, when video after video after video of innocent black person being harassed, attacked, killed, murdered by cops over and over and over and over again, consistently to this day. I mean, I saw something on the news today, you know, another young innocent kid, that I was like, oh my fucking God, the OJ reaction, it just made so much sense. Like, if you grow up with black parents telling you, you better be careful because these people aren't our friends, you know, and in that community, you know, of cousins, brothers, fathers, people who've been harassed by the cops, why wouldn't you identify with OJ and think, and especially when that trial, that cop used the N word. You know, when you rethink about it all, and you kind
clearly planted evidence.
And planted evidence. Mm-hmm. So even though I still believe OJ did it, I totally get the belief that he had been set up. Mm. And I mean, really, like, I don't, yeah, I mean, it is fascinating. We really, we can all grow up in the same country, but based solely on our experiences with the world, you know, our viewpoints are so radically different. Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it kind of bothers me in some ways that, like, I didn't have awareness, you know, when, I mean, I remember at the time, a lot of people were talking about how police were treating black folks. Mm-hmm. And I think as white people, we wanted to understand, we thought we were being progressive, but I don't think we really did enough.
No,
I don't think we really listened.
The people like Hillary Clinton, she was taken to task for this, for that comment about, like, the you know, black people being like super predators. Remember that? That was kind of, that was in the 90s, you know, in around the same era, right?
So fucked up. Mm-hmm. So fucked up. And, you know,
we live here in Chicago, and so, you know, we see very firsthand a lot of the abuse of the Chicago Police Department against black people. And
yeah,
almost like I'm friends with Andy Thayer, who's a political activist here in town. And it's like he's always releasing, you know, something on Facebook or some new statement of yet another person who was exonerated for crimes that they were charged with in the 90s. And they're just getting out of jail now.
It's nauseating. Mm-hmm. It's disgusting. And it's basically, you know, I think, you know, if you watch that documentary on Netflix, 13, which I totally highly recommend everyone watch. Mm-hmm. You know, we really have not evolved to the degree that we want, that white people want to believe we have, as far as our history regarding slavery. And what's her name? Ava DuVernay, the filmmaker, is so brilliant, and she just traces the lineage from slavery to today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people really need to watch that because it really lays it all out. And, you know, we're really a mess. I mean, it's horrible. And basically our prison system today is essentially legalized slavery.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's part of the conversation about, you know, who gets to vote. And most recently, Peter Buttigieg
is running for president.
He's running for president. And part of it is, like, you know, I would say most of the candidates all agree that they don't want people who are in prison voting.
I don't know.
Although Sanders is saying everybody should get to vote.
I think other people have come forward and say that if you are in prison, you should still be allowed to vote. I mean, why should your right to vote be taken away? But Pete Buttigieg is like, no, I don't think you should be able to vote. But then we look at these people who have been incarcerated, you know, for crimes that they did not commit. You know, and some people, like, especially like queer and people of color, you know, it's not.
That's the dilemma, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we know that we're dealing with a failed system. So in theory, if we were, if there was true justice, then maybe taking people's rights away when they go to prison might make sense. You know, if we were dealing with an honest and, you know, a system with integrity that we could all believe stood for justice. Mm-hmm. But we all know that's not what we're dealing with. We have black men in prison for marijuana. You know, it's gross. And we know that racism has driven the sentences of many, many, many people of color, you know, and, you know, white people get a different shake in the courthouse.
Well, it's prohibition, you know, talking about the time of Fatty Arbuckle, prohibition made organized crime into a major financial powerhouse that where they were able to partner up with corrupt politicians and help launch their political careers. And so in essence, it's why prohibition, even though it was, you know, it was an amendment in the Constitution in 1919, it was removed and ended in 1933. And it's only until Nixon started passing prohibition on drugs where that became a tool for conservative and regressive politicians to stay in power. But it's the same idea, you know, it's like, and only in this case, the organized crime is the pharmaceutical industry. And so in talking about, you know, murder and celebrities who kill people, it's really hard not to talk about these other things as well.
Mm. Well, and when you hear somebody like Donald Trump just repeat those words, law and order, you know, he's basically saying we're going to lock black people up. And that's what these white people, they understand that that's what it is, that we're going to be separate and that there's going to be segregation and there's going to be a separation. And that's what's going to happen. We are going to reinforce the law and the order.
Now, when it comes to, like, celebrities being murdered by their fans, we inevitably think of Selena being murdered by the head of her fan club. Mm. And she was obsessed because, I guess, you know, Selena confronted her in a hotel room and said, you know, you're stealing money from people. And she was just like, she was so heartbroken at the thought of not being able to be the president of her fan club that she pulled out a gun and shot her. And you know... And conversely, there's the story of Beretta, Robert Blake. He was, I guess, he shot his wife.
We don't know if exactly allegedly. For sure he was shot. He was actually, you know, he went to trial for murdering his wife, Bonnie Lee Blakely, but he was found, you know, not guilty. He was acquitted. But then later he was found liable for wrongful death in a civil lawsuit in order to pay like $30 million to her surviving relatives. And I think later it was shot down to like $15 million. Because the story was, is that, you know, he was having dinner with her in a restaurant and then she went out to the car. He came back in because he had forgotten his gun in the restaurant, and then she was shot while he was inside the restaurant. And so it was clear that it wasn't his gun that did it. Now, Robert Blake owned a lot of guns. They said that, like, in every room of his house, he had guns. So
he's not well in the head.
And he may have had somebody kill her for him. So we don't know. But, Bonnie,
what do you think?
You know,
I think Robert Blake had something to do with it for sure.
Absolutely. And now there's a reason I want to bring this up is because a lot of people sort of focus on Robert Blake, you know, murdering his ex-wife, but a lot of people
His wife at the time.
A lot of people don't realize who Bonnie Lee Blakely was. Mm-hmm. She was insane. And I'm not saying this. She had a bunch of legal problems. She was doing like a mail order fraud business. She was stalking all these other celebrities. Mm-hmm. And before she was even in a relationship with Robert Blake, she was obsessed with Marlon Brando's son.
And who is also had gone to jail for murdering someone. So she had tangled with two murders. She had an affair with Marlon Brando's son, and Marlon Brando's son had gone to jail because he had killed his sister's boyfriend because he was supposedly abusing the girlfriend.
She had a type.
Yeah. So she...
She had been married 10 times before she married Robert Blake. Most of her marriages lasted a day.
Mm-hmm. The longest marriage she had was to her first cousin. It lasted 5 years. But Bonnie got pregnant by Marlon Brando's son and even named the kid like Cheyenne Brando. But then she got together with Robert Blake and she's just like, Robert, I think the kid might be yours. And so they had like a paternity test and it actually turned out to be Robert Blake's kid. And so he married her. And they had changed the name of the kid and everything. But Bonnie, like, she's like, I love that she had like a Lonely Hearts Club ads and magazines. And so she would write to men and send them pictures of herself and other women in the nude. And she had a bunch of different fake IDs and a bunch of different postal accounts that she would do this. So in lots of ways, she had like her Only for Fans. She was a very early Only for Fans adopter. And I guess she'd gotten like lots of money for guys, but she wanted to be.
The mail fraud was that the nature of the mail fraud of the business is that she would run these ads and magazines that would offer companionship to lonely men. And she would pretend like she was only having, you know, she would create this false identity and have this relationship with these men and extort them for money.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, she dealt with a lot of legal problems.
Yeah, I mean, she had gone to jail. She had to work like
I don't know if you guys have ever seen the movie The Honeymoon Killers, but it's fabulous. Such a good movie.
What's that about?
And, it's a real story, a real life couple. I mean, they weren't famous, so they weren't celebrities who killed, but they were killers. They would put ads. Well, what did you call them? Love ads?
Lonely Hearts Club. Lonely Hearts Club band.
They would put those kind of ads in, newspapers and stuff, and then seduce young, single, lonely women. And then, the wife in it is Shirley Stoller, who was, like, kind of a big, fat lesbian at the time. Her ex-girlfriend came to Midnight Mass when we screened it.
Oh, shit.
Back in the early 2000s, and she was so, a total butch and so sweet and so excited. But let's just say that Shirley Stoller is almost like a divine character if – she were a woman, very like Pat Ast or something. You listeners who like my kind of movies should really, really check out The Honeymoon Killers. But anyways, she ended up with this hot man, the real life lady, an exotic, tall, dark, and handsome man. In the movie, he's played by Tony LoBianco, who is so sexy. And basically, she uses him as the bait, And so they meet these women, seduce these women, marry them, kill them. It's all basically they murder them. They just full on murder them. But it's all based on a true story.
Oh, wow.
The true couple is called Raymond Fernandez and Martha Beck. And they were called the Lonely Hearts Killers of the 1940s.
Now, Bonnie, she was obsessed with celebrities. She was kind of like, those celebrity bloggers who are like always stalking and learning about them and trying to befriend them. She stalked and developed a relationship with Jerry Lee Lewis.
Then that's when she lived in Tennessee.
Yes.
And then she's like, I got a taste of stardom, so like, I'm going to go out to L.A.
Dean Martin, Frankie Valli, Gary Busey. And then that's when she finally got involved with Christian Brando. And that led her to having a relationship and ultimately marrying Robert Blake.
She had a type. I mean, just listen to those people you mentioned. You know what I mean? Like, she had a type.
I don't want to say like she had it coming, but, she was definitely dancing.
She had it coming.
She definitely liked to dance with the devil in the pale moonlight. And it was I could just imagine that what kind of person she is. She actually released an album or she had a single.
She had a single that she paid for. So it was pressed. It was a private pressing. And she recorded on the name Lee Bonnie. It was Lee Bonnie Records. And its title is Just a Fan. And then it was just like it's her writing like, I'm going to basically stalk you. And it needs some auto tune. It needs a little bit of work. Should we play a little clip?
Yeah.
Let's play a little clip. Here we go, so you can hear some of it. I don't know if you've heard it or not.
Enough.
You can see
I don't mean to speak ill of the dead, but she sucks.
Everybody's a music critic, but it's not a reason to kill somebody.
Well, I don't want to celebrate her death.
I don't want to celebrate her
death. But it was just like, my God, it was just like, if you had to listen to that song every day, you'd kill her, for sure.
Yeah, but I mean, sadly, I think she... I mean, no one deserves to be killed. Mm. But also, too, you do kind of question, like, well, what were you thinking hanging out with these people? Like, Robert Blake is clearly so terrifyingly unhinged, you know?
Well, that's why she was attracted to danger,
you know?
Yeah, clearly.
I mean, he was a little rascal. Did you know that?
I forgot, but I do remember that now.
And
yeah.
He turned into a big rascal.
Isn't that wild?
The thing is like, if you're in a relationship with somebody who has guns in every single room of their house, you have to wonder, like, why and what's going to happen someday, you know? Mm.
Well, we have a friend who built and repaired guns and stuff, and, you know.
I still wonder what's going to happen.
And I'm a little nervous around him. Know? I said that to him. I was like, baby, I love you, but your obsession with guns makes me basically, you know, not want to be alone in your house with you.
And he's like, you should be scared.
Yeah, that's what he said.
They want people to be scared, I think.
Oh, for sure.
And that's it to me. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. people come up to us all the time. They're like, I got this stalker. I got this, obsessed person who's making my life hell. And Mark and I noticed that stalkers by nature tend to be very lazy people. Mm. They tend to put their emotional baggage onto you and make you responsible for their happiness. And so one way we've over the years gotten rid of stalkers is by putting them to work.
Ask them to do things for you. Then they're just like, no, thanks.
We just shove them like a stack of flyers and say, hey, do you mind putting these on cars?
And then,
and they're gone. They take the flyers, throw in a dumpster, and you never hear from them again.
Peaches, what's your, I know you're a fan of the Aliens movies. There are many Aliens movies. What is your opinion of Aliens 3?
The prison planet.
When it first came out, I was not a fan of it. Mm-hmm. I've grown to appreciate it more over time. Mm. But I really, really, the first Alien is perfect. Mm-hmm. And the second Alien is a great, great movie. But that first Alien is a perfect film. Mm-hmm. And Aliens, the sequel, was one of those sequels that was like, it was just great because it wasn't disappointing. Mm-hmm. It was so good. And I actually, you know, if you kind of remove it from the sort of universe of the first two movies, I really liked the what's the one the French Genet did? Maybe it's part four.
Resurrection, you mean?
Yes, with Winona Ryder.
With all the twisted bodies in the bottles and stuff.
Kill me.
But just my favorite line of all the art and film. Every drag queen will knows this line. Get away from her, you bitch!
Oh, yeah. That's from the second one, Aliens.
Is that from Showgirls or from...
Oh, no. That's from Aliens. Mm. And as a kid, watching that movie... I mean, Sigourney Weaver in those films is so incredible. You know, that sort of female archetype back then, it was so refreshing in an era of, you know, Rambo and Die Hard and all those kind of really, I didn't identify with Rambo. I didn't identify with Bruce Willis and Die Hard or any of those, you know, Van Damme. I identified with fucking Sigourney Weaver, you know? I mean, Sigourney Weaver or, what's her name in Terminator? Who was so great.
Oh, Linda Hamilton. Yeah.
But Linda Hamilton.
I was so disappointed when I realized that exoskeletons weren't a real thing. Like, I thought, you know, construction sites used these on a regular basis.
No, but I mean, we're really lucky that we did, you know, not just us, but women, young girls, mm-hmm. like we did have some of those really, great, female strong role models. And I mean, my God, Sigourney Weaver, she's just everything. She's so good in everything she's in. Like, she was such a great sex pot in Ghostbusters.
Mm. Well, don't tell me that Sigourney Weaver killed somebody.
No, Sigourney Weaver didn't, but one of her co-stars in Alien 3 did.
Oh.
Do you know which one?
Is it in our notes? Yeah.
This is like a test.
It's Charles S. Dutton, the black guy in the
show.
He
was the one who had shaved his head obsessively.
He shaved his head and he was like preaching, we all got to change and like, right. Like things are going to be different and stuff like that. And he actually, you know, he was 17, when he was 17 years old, he got into a fight with somebody and killed him. So he was convicted of manslaughter and then was in jail for 7 years.
So
and
beautiful.
Wow. And then he got out and he had a successful movie career.
Well, at one point in time, he was sent into solitary confinement. confinement, and so you were allowed to grab a book. So he grabbed a book by an anthology of black playwrights. He grabbed it by mistake, and he was so taken with the book and the drama that he convinced the warden to have like a drama club, and they put on like a Christmas pageant, and then he got out, and then eventually, you know, he went on to have a pretty good career as an actor.
That's impressive.
That is impressive. Although I really don't like Aliens 3.
No, it's definitely the worst one. I mean, and a big part of the problem in my mind is it's set on a prison planet. Like, who gives a shit?
Mm-hmm.
Can they vote on that prison planet? That's the question.
But I wonder if that's why he may have gotten that role, is because of he had time.
Oh, maybe.
Prison, you know?
Yeah.
You know, another actor that I thought was kind of a strange story, too, is actor Gig Young. He was an actor, and then he got into a movie called The Gay Sisters, and his character's name was Gig Young, and the studio was just like, that's going to be your name from now on. And he's just like, okay. And he won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor in the performance of They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Which, you know, starred Jane Fonda. So he was in that movie, and I don't know, you know, spoiler alert for people that watch this movie, it's, you know, all these contestants enter this dance marathon in like the Santa Monica ballroom, and so they're dancing and like for hours on end, and people are like, you know, I think somebody actually dies during the marathon, and it's very like everyone's filled with ennui, and Jane Fonda is very depressed about the whole kind of thing, and then they eventually discover that the whole thing is really a scam, that like there's this prize money, but you keep getting deducted for like, you know, your food and all these other things, and like there's an entrance fee, and so by the end of it you're really not going to make any money. Mm-hmm. And so this character goes with Jane Fonda towards the end of like the pier, and she pulls out a gun, and she's like, I'm going to kill myself. And he's just like, she's like, I can't do it. You do it for me. And so the character takes the gun and then shoots her dead. And then the cops come, and they're just like, why did you do it? And he's like, they shoot horses, don't they? You know, because like if you're an injured person, you get, you know, you're an injured horse, you get shot. So Gig Young, like he won an Oscar for this. And then like 7 or 8 years later, he shoots his wife and kills her and then kills himself.
And he said, they shoot horses, don't they?
We don't know probably, what exactly he said, but I just thought it was interesting. He was also in Torch Song with Joan Crawford.
Where he sings, doesn't he? Or just is it, this is the movie where Joan Crawford sings?
Joan Crawford dances, but they do a voiceover for her. But it is the infamous thing where she does dances in blackface.
Okay.
Like, they call me a two-faced lady, and she's in blackface.
You know, we're missing someone on this list that's quite important.
Who's that?
Well, one of the stars of Paris is Burning, Dorian Corey.
Whoa.
Oh my god, I totally forgot.
Well, would you say Dorian was an actress?
Well, actor? I would say that she became a celebrity through being on Paris, you know, one of the leads of Paris is Burning. And then it was years later that, you know, after she passed away and they were cleaning out her apartment in New York City, that they found the mummified corpse of one of her, what they assume was one of her Johns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I mean, whether she killed him or he died, it's still pretty fierce that she just kept him wrapped up in her closet. So, I mean, I think we can assume that she probably, you know.
Did the apartment smell? Like, I'm just trying to figure out the logistics.
They say when they were shooting the movie, they did not notice. I think she truly somehow mummified him.
Well, maybe she put him in the bathtub and let the juices run out. I don't know.
If you really want to mummify a body, you do it best by
salt.
No, kitty litter.
Kitty litter?
Yeah, covering the body in kitty litter for days, because the kitty litter will absorb all of
the stuff.
Moisture and shit. Yeah.
But, like, she had that body stuffed in a trunk, and do we actually see the trunk in Paris is Burning? I feel like
I don't know.
Yeah. I think she's sitting on it or something like that.
Oh my god, that'd be amazing.
Because with the drag phenomena, with the drag, you know, rebirth renaissance that we're in, there's a lot of people who have unprecedented access to all these entertainers. And I'm wondering why we don't hear more stories of things going wrong.
You're really hoping for it, aren't you?
No, I'm not, actually. But I know how delicate the relationship between fan and entertainer can be. And I know that there's just so much closeness, so much interaction happening.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I'm actually a little bit surprised by that as well, and I'm worried that that's something yet to happen, unfortunately. You know,
I pray nothing like that ever happens, but God forbid it does, it's going to change things for the worst.
It's gross to say. It's a gross fear to have. And I've actually talked to some of the girls who have really rabid followings, and you know, I mean, they have they're not dummies. You know, they can sense that kind of energy sometimes. You know, and having had you know, a couple experiences myself with it, and you know, Cassandra Peterson, Elvira has talked a lot about having had really scary experiences. Drag, Elvira, Peaches Christ, these sort of like outsider archetypes who stand for difference and weirdness often appeal to folks who can be a little lost or broken, you know? And so I do worry about that for some of these girls, you know, because there are people, there are fans. It's no secret. They post it on, you know, I was going to kill myself, but then I discovered you. You're the only reason I'm here, you know. That's a lot of pressure to put on someone you've never met before, you know.
And that can be turned around really quickly and say, because your new album is so derivative of the last one, I'm going to kill you.
Well, for whatever it is, mental illness is hard to track and understand. And, you know, but certainly I think we can all agree that a young person who was suicidal and did not kill themselves because of someone they watched on television and then is obsessively emailing and tweeting at that person, that's a possible red flag, you know, that that person might be of a danger to themselves or to, you know, the object of their affection. So I think that that's a scary thing to think about. And I'm really, really glad that nothing like that has happened yet. But if some of these, you know, girls, it's like, I would probably, you know, I was glad, let's just say this. I was very, very glad to see the metal detectors and things at DragCon last year. As morbid as that sounds, you know, you might go into a place like that and think, is this really necessary? And I think it makes a lot of sense.
Well, considering what some of those costumes are like, I mean, how, you know what I'm saying? Like, you could, there's some costumes that are made out of metal. So how's that going to work?
And, you know, I mean, they
had metal detectors last year. I mean, they wand you. I mean, there's ways to figure that out.
We had a, you know, back in 2002, I think it was, we had a Feast of Fun show at a Vietnamese restaurant, and they had security there, and they wanded everybody that walked through the front door. And a lot of people were just like, they were like, I can't believe this is happening. I'm just like, it's new to us, but this is their policy. And it's just like, you never know.
Yeah, I mean, it's that thing where, especially after Pulse, it's like, you know, an event like DragCon, you know, big gay pride celebrations, we know that they have been targets, these kinds of events. We know that, you know? So I don't want to be one of those people who lives in fear. I mean, clearly I still go to DragCon and, you know, I still like attend all that stuff. But there is that thing in the back of my head that says, God, I hope they're taking whatever measures they can to make sure that we're all secure and we're safe, you know?
Yeah, no, I don't blame you. Anytime I go to a crowded place like that, it's like, I always know where the exits are.
Yeah,
you always have make to. Sure you just like, look here, like, this is where I'll run. This is who I'll push in front of me when those bullets come. I'm just kidding, you know.
That's what your wife is for.
They'll throw this plate at their head.
Big loss. Drag Race is wrapping up. The front runners, yeah,
we still have like 8 people in there.
They're gonna get rid of like 3 of them.
Because they only go down. They go down to 4, right? So does that mean there's 4 more episodes or 3?
I believe so. Yeah, it's not very many episodes left, but. You know, the front runners are Dr. Silky Ganache, Brooklyn Heights, and of course Miss Vanjie, who knew that she was going to first eliminated last season, probably likely to make it to the end. You just did a show with Brooklyn Heights.
I did, yes.
What is it called? It's
the First Wives Fight Club.
That's a great concept.
It was really, really fun. I mean, sadly, we were supposed to do it in Canada, and that got canceled at the 11th hour.
Is that because Brooklyn Heights is not allowed back in the country or something?
No, the
after
opposite.
Her Celine Dion impersonation, they were like, you are not allowed
in. I haven't seen it yet, but she was so warning us about how terrible it was. And then, you know, Ginger and Raja were like, they said that all of Snatch Game was terrible. Mm-hmm. So I haven't seen it yet. We're actually going to watch it tonight. I'm a little bit late in getting caught up, but I've seen everything up to the last episode. But she was, are you asking me how she was to work with?
I guess so. Is she funnier in your shows than she is on Drag Race?
She was fucking hilarious. Mm. Like, it shocks me that she wasn't funny, because her Goldie Hawn, not only did she show up super prepared, but her Goldie Hawn was hilarious. She's a star. I mean, whether she wins or she doesn't win, I mean, for me watching the show, I've fallen in love with her and I've fallen in love with Evie Oddly. Mm-hmm. And I like a lot of the other girls too. I mean, I'm not, but those are the two where I'm like, wow, I feel like you've got real, something just really special and really unique, you know? And with Brooklyn, it's not just the sort of flawless runway style, but the elegance of her. And honestly, I'm sure working with her in person, you know, I got to see that she's very, very, very funny and very likable, immensely likable in person, just warms everybody, just very easy to be around.
Well, I'm super pleased that Ginger got a chance to work with you, because ever since we met Ginger, she's just like, I want to do one of Peaches' show.
I want to do Peaches'
show. Can you put in a good
show.
Word for me with Peaches? I want to do her show.
I'll see what I can do, Ginger.
She is a pro. Like a pro. Like she, I want to work with her over and over again. We have a concept we're working on now. And she's going to be the star of it. Chucky the Musical.
Awesome.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Don't you think? She said we should call the doll.
I told you she did Chucky. The first time I saw her, I was like, she does Chucky. And then she changes into Bride of Chucky.
We want to do a full show. Well, we think Jinx should play the bride.
Yeah, that would be very good. And who plays Jennifer Tilly?
Well, probably me, because it has to be someone beautiful.
Just get Jennifer Tilly to do it. She's not doing anything.
She's a professional gambler.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
She goes to Las Vegas and just sits there with sunglasses? And
yeah, I mean, Jennifer Tilly's an Academy Award winner. She's one of the, like, she's a great, great, great actor who decided she wasn't interested in acting anymore and started pursuing gambling.
If you ask her, she'll do it.
Well, she, you know, we did a show together and she was fabulous.
I know. I that's why I'm asking, because you're friends with her.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like asking someone to play themselves in a drag parody tribute to something they created, I'm not comfortable doing that necessarily. If anything, I'd have her play something else in the show, you know? Mm-hmm. Like Danny Franzese came to see Mean Gays, and people kept saying, why didn't you ask Danny to do it? And I said, because I talked to Danny and he said, I want to do any of your shows, but I don't want to do the Mean Girls parody. Mm. And I totally get that. He wanted to sit back and enjoy the tribute, you know?
Mm. Well, you got Barry Boswick to dress up in drag how many years later?
Oh, a million. It was a long time. Like, we did that maybe 6 or 7 years ago now, I guess.
He hasn't dressed up in drag since or before, right?
No. And I mean, I've told that story on this podcast, but that was such a great, I feel like I'm not easily surprised. And Barry Bostwick was brilliant in the way that he surprised me. He showed up at the theater that night. I said to him, would you like to sit in the back of the auditorium and watch our pre-show performance tribute, you know, to Rocky Horror? Like, all my drag queen friends were doing a medley, and then I'll bring you up on stage, you know? And he said, no, can I just sit in your dressing room back here? I'll wait. They'll let me know when you're ready for me. That's how he said it. And I was like, what's that?
You were a little hurt?
Oh my God. I was so bummed. I thought, he really is an asshole. Cause you know, that's what they yell at him and the thing. And I was like, I can't believe it. I can't believe I'm doing this show. But what he was doing was setting me up to be disappointed, because he used my dressing room to get in full Rocky Horror floor show drag, the fishnets, the boa, the corset, all of it.
Mm. He still looked good. He still got his legs.
He got his leg up in the air. Yeah, it was amazing. That was a deathbed memory for sure.
Is it tricky?
Oh, by the way, if I sound unlike myself on your podcast, it's because my allergies have decided to declare war on me, and I think they're going to win, honestly.
Whoa. Honey, we're the same way. Hey, yeah. Since you have a lot of celebrities coming to San Francisco to do shows, and you're also associated with John Waters and the Dreamlanders, the filthiest people alive, mailing poop to each other, you know, there's been a news item that's being circulated this week that in San Francisco, human feces on the sidewalk have exploded. And since last time we were in San Francisco, it's almost like double the amount of spotted poop in San Francisco's sidewalk.
Uh-huh.
What do you warn the actors or like celebrities, like, hey, just be careful, look down when you're walking around.
Up 25% or something, isn't it?
In 1 year, up 25%, yeah.
I mean, it's so disgusting in general that I guess I feel like it's been bad for a while, so it surprises me that it's gotten worse. But yeah, it's part of living in this city. I mean, I hate to say it, but San Francisco is a terrible example of where this country is headed as far as economic disparity and what capitalism without any social responsibility can do to a place. And so we are, you know, ground zero for tech billions. I mean, literally billions of dollars is being made here. We're the most expensive city in the country. And while the few rich get richer, the poor get poorer. And, you know, it's just a really strange place to be. It feels like, you know, living in kind of a third world country. It reminds me of when I was in Manila. And, you know, I hate to be such a Debbie Downer about it all, but I honestly think that as we move towards more and more automation and computers taking over jobs and this country getting richer, you know, and by that I mean the rich getting richer, I worry for the future of this country. You know, I don't know how we can sustain capitalism.
We need a universal basic income is what you're saying.
Kind of. I mean, that's, you know, that's what they do in oil rich countries. You know, we're going to have to figure it out. Dividends or forced dividends for citizens is going to be, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. Otherwise there's going to be a fucking French Revolution here because, you know, they talk about, you know, Donald Trump has the lowest unemployment, you know, right, blah, blah, blah. It's so because people are working five jobs.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know. My friends and the people around me, it's not getting easier. It's getting harder. And
is it harder for you to like find people to volunteer and to participate in your shows?
Well, we don't use volunteers anymore. We stopped. Once we realized that we could pay everybody, we just started paying everybody.
But even then, so it's still not. Are they all regular gigs for them? Or is it a situation where they have to make sacrifices?
I think for my shows, honestly, what you have are people who have jobs and enjoy doing my shows as a hobby. Mm-hmm. You know, even though they're getting paid, it's not a job for them. There's maybe a handful of people that work with me where my productions are their main source of income. I mean, literally, I can think of two, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But most people who work on these kinds of shows, because it's so inconsistent as well. Like, you know, I'll do a show and then, you know,
they do it cause they love it.
Yeah. Like we don't really have a big show in San Francisco again until July.
What's you that going to be?
It's going to be Bring It On Queen.
What's that about?
It's, do you know the movie Bring It On?
I don't think I actually saw it, but
you don't know that movie? Yes.
Yeah. I saw the trailer.
So it's Cheer Troops. Okay. So it's Bob the Drag Queen versus Monet Exchange.
Ah. Who's going to win?
So, well, you have to come and see it and find out.
San Francisco in the summer.
I'm obsessed with Strawberry Shortcake, from who played the mom in Mean Gays, among other characters.
Yeah, she's fabulous.
Where is she at? Like, it's just a matter of time.
She's from Seattle.
Before she gets on Drag Race. She's just a natural-born star.
She's from Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
She normally has a mustache. She does drag with a mustache.
Mm.
And for Mean Gays, when I cast her, I said, I have allowed you and support your mustache, allowed you to perform with that mustache and drag, but I don't see cool mom with a mustache. So the part is yours, but you have to agree to shave off the mustache. And I guess she hadn't shaved it for like 7 years. And she did, and she agreed with me, you know, after it was over that it was the right decision. But I just saw a picture of her. She did the mothership to Reno, whatever they call it now, trip. And she had her mustache back, so.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah, I actually like hers. Mm-hmm. I'm into bearded and facial hair drag when I feel like it works. You know, I love Grace Towers. I think, you know, and I love a lot of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence who wear beards. Mm-hmm. So I like some bearded queens, but I mean, don't get me started on fucking Lady Bear. You know, I just don't like it. I don't support
lazy.
It.
Do you think it's just lazy drag?
It's totally lazy. And it's all about her wanting to get dick when she's a boy and she's lost a bunch of weight.
What is the situation for me? I shaved for Mean Girls and I got so much shit from my coworkers and people, and they're just like, who are you? They look at me without the beard and they're just like, I don't even feel like I know you anymore. And even like we're posting, you know, Cooking with Drag Queens episodes and we're all wearing beards, but in real life, we're all clean shaven here. And it's, you know, underneath this beard is this like senior citizen, you know, and the beard is really a great tool for people to be able to hide the aging of their face.
Oh, really?
Huh. Oh, yeah.
I often think people shave and they look younger.
Well, to some degree, but
I recently shaved and Fausto said I looked older, but everybody that I work with said, oh my God, you look so much younger. I'm like, oh really?
Yeah, Thank you. A lot of times I feel like people shave and they do look younger.
Mm. It's tricky, you know.
Fausto, don't be crazy.
So you want me to shave on a regular basis?
I think we should not get so attached one way or the other. You know, I grow facial hair and then I do peaches, and I love giving Lady Bear a hard time, but I do hate her beard when she's in drag. I hate it. I hate it so much.
Do you not cast her in things because she won't shave?
Oh, she would. We had a knockdown drag out fight about it. Because she wanted to do Bear Barella with her beard after we had already done it a million times with no beard, including, you know, photo shoots and posters. And I told her, I said, I'll replace you.
And did you?
No, she shaved.
Ah. Tell her she should just get one of those prosthetic beards or something, you know, and just glue it on for when she wants dick.
Yeah. You know? Well, I mean, the other thing is it's like, I don't know, like it doesn't take that long to regrow your facial hair.
Yeah.
I guess if you're doing drag a lot, though, you know,
it takes about a month. But for me, it's like my beard is like
mine takes like a week and a half.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're a beast. Oh,
my beard is totally. Yeah, I'm like super. I'm raging with testosterone. Oh my God.
You need to up your estrogen dose.
Probably, yeah. That's why, yeah, it's, but now I forget what I was going to say. Oh, my beard has started to turn very silver. I just, I kind of noticed it the other day and I said to Nihat, oh my God, my beard is like so gray. And he was like, uh-huh. And I was like, how long has it been like this? And he said, is that a serious question? I said, yes. And he was like, I don't know, a year or two?
Well, I love the streaks of silver in Nihat's hair. It's just very, very, very handsome. I was like, I were to go silver, I would like to go silver like that.
Yeah, his is cool because it's like silver all like kind of, what's the word? Evenly distributed all around. Yeah. Mm.
And it beautifully frames his, you know, very olive skin face.
Like, I want just a shock of, like, a streak, like Nancy from A Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, where she wakes up after her bad dream and she has, like, a streak of white hair.
Wasn't that Poltergeist?
Poltergeist 2, yeah. And yeah. All About Evil. I gave Deborah a streak. Natasha, we streaked her hair. She was like, why are we doing this? And I said,
shut up and do what I tell you. Poltergeist,
A Nightmare on Elm Street, these are
I went to high school with a girl. Her name was Lori, and her mother was she won Miss Polonaise, which is like the Miss Polonia contest or whatever. And her mother had this great giant bouffant that was black, and it was just enormous. And she had a silver squiggle that came from her widow's peak back and forth up this giant bouffant. It was like, you know,
the Bride of Frankenstein. That's flawless.
Yeah, but it was in the center. Instead of at the sides. It was just where everybody that ever saw her were like, how does she even do that?
She's a witch.
She is a witch. So what else you got going on? So you got Bring It On Bitches, Bring It On Queens.
Yeah, well, it's called Bring It On Queens. So that's a Bring It On parody with Bob the Drag Queen and Monet Exchange. But before then, next week I go to England, and I'll be in England for all of May doing a run in Manchester and London of Drag Becomes Her. So for any of your UK listeners, Drag Becomes Her is running in Manchester, I think, for a week, and then for like 3 or 4 weeks in London.
It's you, Jinx, and who else?
Ben De La Creme and Major Scales.
Okay.
And tickets, there's like a ton of the shows are already sold out, which is so nice and so great. Yeah. So get your tickets now. And then June, I have a bunch of Pride stuff. Oh my God, I'm doing Mean Gays in Boise, Idaho. I've never been to Idaho.
Oh, wow. Well, you've been to hell in Idaho.
That's right.
You can get Vice Quigley Bones in your show.
That would be great. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I can put the hell in Idaho when Willem is in the show. Mm. Oh, you know.
That's pretty sure.
I think that's a is that going to be with Kimchi as well?
Yes, Kimchi is in it. Uh-huh. Yeah, the same show you guys saw in Chicago.
And Strawberry Shart Cake.
Yes, she'll be in it. Yes, exactly. That's the same cast. Yeah, all of those guys. I can't wait. We really bonded doing that trip, so I'm looking forward to seeing them again.
What's interesting is that when you turn to the audience at the end of the show, spoiler alert, skip forward, and you turn to the audience and you say, raise your hand if you've ever been bullied by Willem. And the audience was like, yeah, I really have been, you know. There was a lot of people who were like sincerely raising their hand.
Personally victimized is the line.
That's the line. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was Willem like, maybe I should, you know, be nice
to him? She loved it.
I didn't realize she did
kind of say to me, she was like, it is kind of weird. I don't see myself as a bitch, and everyone keeps telling me how perfectly cast I was in the show. It's starting to make me like wonder, like, I not know that I'm a bitch?
Yeah, it's really funny when people are bitches and they don't know it. There was a local drag queen in town. She's sitting here at our kitchen counter, and she says to Faust, she's like, you know, those people, they told me she was a bitch. They told me I was a bitch. And I was just like, are you kidding? You don't know that you're one of the biggest bitches there are? You know, and she's just like, she had absolutely no clue. Now, don't get me wrong. I love a bitch. I love somebody who's fierce. I love people that call it like it is. I love it when people say funny things. I love people when they say mean things just to be kind of funny. You know what I mean? And the playful spirits. I told her, it was like, I adore that part of it. But like the fact that you don't recognize that everything that comes out of your mouth is really fucking bitchy just surprises me.
And that's hilarious.
And you are that unaware. And to be honest with you, she hasn't been over since.
Are you going to say who it is?
Dixie Lynn Cartwright.
Well, part of it is I think she was hurt. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that, you know, in terms of like dynamics and drag scenes, there's always like the haves and the have nots. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I think sometimes the queens who are sort of successful forget about the struggle that they've gone through, and they start picking on people who sometimes are hurting. And I'm not saying
That definitely happens. I mean, that's the sad. I mean, that's, I think a lot of this hideous Drag Race culture are kids who've probably been bullied, who've probably been teased, and then they get online and they start attacking people on television and, you know, attacking each other. And, you know, and you're kind of going, hey guys, wait a minute. This is no different than the bullies who, you know, are jocks that push you down and steal your lunch money. You're the same.
Well, I've even crossed that line with you once or twice.
When you called me fat.
No, it was. Do you remember what it was about?
What? I remember when I was annoyed because you made fun of me, my Wednesday Addams. That's you said what I looked like Wednesday Addams with the glandular problem.
We were doing a show about costumes, and I know that you are a regular listener, and I wanted to sort of speak to you indirectly, give you an Easter egg. And I know that you also make a lot of jokes about your figure, so I talked about that, and it backfired.
I wasn't hurt. I was pissed.
You were very upset with me.
Because I'll tell you why. In the world of drag, I get called fat all the time, and I can completely handle it. You know, my roast was all about I'm fat, I'm talentless, my makeup is terrible. And in the world of drag, I think that's fine. Mm-hmm. But if someone were to say that about me behind my back when I wasn't there to dish it back, I think that's something else entirely.
But that's a part of your like jokes and your routine and your brand, isn't it? Or is it like a situation where it, because for me, it's like I'm trying to think like, well, what does Peaches make fun of herself for? And I was just like trying to sort of like align with that. But I think sometimes, you know, a lot of our humor and a lot of our self-deprecating humor is actually us sort of dealing with a lot of the feelings.
Well, you'd have to pull up the show, right? Because yeah. my memory of the show was that it was a very specific thing.
And I really like care about you as a person. I said you look like a thick Amish girl, but part of it was like,
no, you said I looked like you were talking about like you don't want to do Wednesday Addams if you're going to look like Wednesday Addams with a glandular problem
and, or something. Yeah. And I was not like, part of me is like, you know, as soon as I heard that had hurt your feelings, I was mortified because I really care about you as a person. And it's also something I would never dream of saying about anybody else. But I was saying it about you because I had watched your performances for so many years.
Well, you didn't say it about me. That's all you said. No, it was about me, but it was coded. No. You didn't say who it was about.
Because I didn't mention you by name. That's why.
Yeah. It was very like coded. And you talked about how I looked in the poster, but you didn't want to name who it was. And when I listened to it, and I remember listening to it a couple times, I was like, no, this is like it didn't feel like drag queen shade. It felt like someone being mean.
Well, I am sorry about that because I value you as a friend and I really care about you. And I overstepped my boundary there.
Oh, shit. My Lyft ride is here. I'm so sorry. I have to be somewhere.
That's okay, darling. We've kept you long enough. Be well and thank you so much.
Take care. And forgive me for crossing that line.
Oh, I the nice thing about our relationship is I was able to talk to you about it and mm-hmm. I moved on. Mm-hmm. I don't even, you know, I would never even hold on to something like that.
God, I feel like I'm on the Real Housewives of Drag right now.
But that's a good way to do it. If you have a problem with someone, you should talk to them about
without
it.
Without
a
doubt.
Just pick up the phone and call me.
Yeah, exactly. Which is what we did.
Okay. Best of luck, darling.
I love you, sweetie. Have a great
later,
night.
Later, fat asses.
Have fun in the UK. Don't eat all the
right,
beans.
Thanks, you guys. Bye. I won't. All right, bye.
Peaches Christ lives in San Francisco, California.
If you're in the UK, you can check out her performance, her show that she's doing with Jinx Monsoon, Ben De La Creme, and Major Scales in Drag Becomes Her, a parody of the classic movie with Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn. Death Becomes Her.
Get your tickets now, because those things do sell out, yes. Folks.
Now a warning.
Be warned. You know. Have been warned.
Yes.
Buy your ticket or you will be hurt.
And when you go to the meet and greet, tell Peaches and then you listen to her on Feast of Fun. And maybe she'll give you a little something extra.
Only if you're nice to her.
Only if you're nice to her.
And don't.
Don't tell her she looks like an Amish person with a glandular problem.
Just say that.
You get a phone call.
Or just be like, you know, Fausto's so stupid. Mm. You know, because some of our fans, some of the listeners,
they do that kind of stuff.
They don't tell us they enjoy the show.
No.
They don't say, oh my God, I love you. They don't buy a Patreon membership.
Which you can do at patreon.com/feastoffun, because that's a great way to support the podcast, or do it at feastoffun.com/plus.
They don't do that. They contact the guest mm-hmm. after the fact and said, I can't believe that you do. And part of it is just like, I think in terms of, you know, queer community, in terms of mm-hmm. artist community and people who are, living in a bohemian sensibility, we have a hard time sticking together.
Mm.
It's very easy to be like, why are you hanging out with those people? And blah, blah, blah.
Mm.
And it's easy to just walk away from that. When you get your feelings hurt, when you feel like you're not being respected, when you feel like people are wasting your time,
mm-hmm.
it's very tempting to just walk away. And I'm deeply grateful that all these years later that we have a relationship with somebody like Peaches Christ, and I'm, mm-hmm. that I have a wonderful husband like you, Mark.
Oh, thank you. And I have a wonderful husband like you, Fausto.
And it's easy to not be together. It's easy to split apart.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, you know, someone like Brian Sweeney, I consider a brother. And to me, it's like, we're going to disagree on things on the show. Mm-hmm. We're not going to see things eye to eye.
Mm.
I'm going to call him Thanos because he wants to get rid of half of the internet.
Aww.
You know, and part of it is like, I'm very aligned with the way things Brian sees, but I also don't want to be in a situation where I'm not acknowledging the benefits of the world we live in as much as the challenges we're facing.
Mm.
And in order to overcome those challenges, we have to think about, you know, the good stuff as well as the bad stuff.
Mm.
And we only can do this through conversation. And I think that's why Feast of Fun and this podcast specifically is so valuable to us and to our community and to our guests and to our listeners, because we are an opportunity for people to reflect on these ideas and to look at the history of arts and entertainment and culture and murder and learn from it and not repeat those mistakes. You know, Roscoe Arbuckle's story is something, is an allegory. The prohibition is those issues and those crises and the way we created that world back then is something we're still dealing with today.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to overcome that by understanding the mindset of what set mm-hmm. that in motion in the first place. The only way we can do that is by learning about our history and herstory. So I want to thank the listeners for tuning in today and to listening to the show. And remember, there's a lot more goodies and more podcasts on feastoffun.com/plus. And if you want to become a more modest subscriber, you can do so at patreon.com/feastoffun.
Every little bit helps. You can also go to feastoffun.com/donate and make a one-time donation.
That's right. We also accept Venmo.
Mm-hmm. At Feast of Fun.
Rafa just gave a nice donation.
Thank you, Rafa. You're the best.
We love you guys.
Bye-bye.